You're listening to the Musical Ecology's Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecology series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on Thursday, October 13th with composer and sound artist Andrea Parkins. Widely regarded for her improvisational electroacoustic performances, Parkins presented her solo project, which explored extended accordion techniques with electronic feedback and live sound processing through her self-designed virtual instruments. But we began the evening with a wide-ranging conversation about her background in music and the visual arts, as well as other aspects of her career. Let's listen now to my conversation with Andrea Parkins at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Welcome again, and so I guess where should we begin? How about we begin? How about in Pittsburgh? We were talking about Pittsburgh earlier.
I mean, that's a good place to start the story.
I mean, this is where you're from. I mean, I guess it's a launching pad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess what I hope to do in our conversation, at least get a little more background. I mean, I know your work a little bit, and I know you a little bit, but there's still some questions that I have. So you're from Pittsburgh, and so how? Let's trace maybe in some form how you got from Pittsburgh to here.
To this room.
Let's trace that journey.
It's about 8 hours. Wow, it's a long one. Right. But I've been talking about the journey a lot. It sounds so hippie groovy, but I've been talking about the journey a lot, and it's kind of, I've been thinking about it as a journey through technology a little bit. If the first technology could be a piano, or the underside of a piano, mm-hmm. you know, like when you're very small and you're under the piano, and that's mm-hmm. a resonant space, and then sort of climbing up on the bench eventually and learning how to play this part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a pretty serious classical pianist growing up and into my 20s. Around in my teens, I have an older brother who brought home 2 jazz records. I had not heard jazz, but he brought home a Sonny Rollins record and a Thelonious Monk record, which I wore out. Wow. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to learn how to be a jazz musician? So I went to Berklee College of Music, and they said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here to learn how to be a jazz musician. They said, well, you're a classical pianist. What are you doing here? You know, I mean, I thought you went to school to learn what you don't know, but apparently not. So I dropped out at 19 and was a waitress and worked in bookstores and
in Boston.
Yes, mm-hmm. and did accounts payable for a Gestalt therapist and a Rolfer, and you know had many jobs. And one day I had an astute, much older boyfriend who said, "Honey, you need to go to art school." Hmm. And he handed me a Bolex Super 8 camera and he said, "Here, go make some films."
Nice.
And I ended up studying. I'm going through all of this because it's actually important.
Sure.
But it was a long, slow slog. I studied experimental film with Phil Solomon at Mass College of Art at night, mm-hmm. and I started to understand something about structure and about composition from looking at cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Expanded cinema, but also, you know, other things, you know, before that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But also really learning to appreciate stasis, learning to appreciate, you know, thinking about semiotics for the first time,
mm-hmm.
and understanding that that's actually something alive. It's, you know, how I make sense and how I think of things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I also was fortunate enough to study sound with somebody who was a very good friend of Phil's, and I don't know what became of him, a guy named Rick Wolf, who was absolutely a poet of sound. And at that time, I started making my first sound pieces, which this would have been about 1982.
And this was at Mass Art, you're
still? This was Mass Art at night, and they were music concrete pieces, quarter-inch tape. I still have my splicing block, you know, with a Revox or a Tascam. You know, I think I had access to both. And so that was the beginning of me. There were several threads happening at once. That was one thing. Another thing was that I started playing in punk bands, playing synthesizer. And the third thing was that I had, after quitting piano for a while, I started studying again. I started studying improvisation with a gentleman named Harvey Diamond, who was a student of Lenny Tristano's. And for the first time, I was thinking about improvisation in terms of sound, even though it was within jazz, because they have a very kind of specific, people who study with Tristano had a very specific approach. There's like several tunes that they do, and you don't transcribe solos, you sing them. So these were the things that were all coming together, and eventually I went to art school, where I thought I would make sound and film, and the school was not good at that, so I didn't do that there. I thought, I'll do what they have, which is good, which was drawing and sculpture, and that was the Museum School in Boston at that time. That's what they were good at. There have been much better film teachers there since.
Much better than Phil Solomon?
No, he was at Mass Art, but Abigail Child was at, and this is Abigail Child, was at the Museum School.
I see.
But that happened later. And so thinking about music technology, thinking about piano, thinking about quarter-inch tape, thinking about my first solos, which were before there were samplers, which were many, many, many cassette machines that I was turning off and on because there were no samplers yet. And then someone did give me an accordion, and I thought, I don't know. But I started playing in a band and then eventually started plugging it in so it would be loud enough to be heard with the guitars, and then started thinking about how to affect it, hence guitar pedals. But it's interesting with the guitar pedals because there's a bazillion effects that one can use. And I sort of ended up choosing just several that I've stayed with for about 20 years, more or less.
You mean the very pedals?
Pretty much the very pedals, with one or two exceptions.
Specific models, at the very least.
So, after cassettes came standalone samplers, which were floppy disks, came very unstable sampling software, came Max MSP. Which finally, and that would have been about 2002, that would have been the moment where I started really thinking about what does it mean to be an acoustic musician and the physicality with which you're engaging with your instruments, and how can I do that with digital instruments. And I got a residency at Harvest Works, and they said, we can teach you how to program Max, or we can find you a programmer. And me being kind of lazy, they found me a programmer. But I went through three or four or five of them, because the thing about technology is that if you've never used it and you don't know what it does, it's hard to ask someone to do something with it. If you don't know what it does, how do you know what to ask?
So who was the programmer that finally...
The programmer that made my life beautiful is Matthew Ostrowski, who's a fantastic electronic musician. And he made the first version of the patch that I call Goldberg, which is named after Rube Goldberg, that I've been using since then. And we've had many iterations that... And what it is, basically, is a way for me to do sound processing of live material and also some pre-recorded sampled material. All of my sounds are my own. And through a sampling pathway that is somewhat randomized and is unpredictable by me, so that I'm engaging with it as a kind of obstreperous improvisational partner. And in a way like George Lewis's Voyager, but a lot more, more badly behaved, I guess. And I'm really interested in, and I'm interested in the tension really when things begin to fall apart, when, sometimes the way it's set up, I might trigger something and it doesn't work. And that's like, and that's fine. I just have to negotiate that. And that's part of what I'm interested in. That creates a certain physical tension.
Right. Well, this is kind of...
So that's the story.
This is sort of intrinsic to Max MSP in general, right?
Yes,
I mean, and
absolutely.
And to the whole interactive electronic relationship. There's some unpredictability, certainly.
Yes,
and
yes.
So you're working with Goldberg tonight?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So that's in the mix. Well, great. Well, that's quite a journey. So you spent a lot of time in Boston. When did you come to New York?
I moved to New York in 1991 to go to graduate school for visual arts at Rutgers. Mm-hmm. And also to play music in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I've been here since then.
Right, yeah. So the visual arts component of your world is certainly getting to here was a big part of it.
It's crucial.
Yeah,
I would say it's crucial. Yeah.
So then that informs your work a lot today, I presume.
Absolutely.
So I didn't know that you were a pianist. What role does piano? I mean, I guess the accordion is maybe.
I practice the piano every day.
You do?
Yes, I do.
So
I play scales and arpeggios, and I play those Tristano lines with the the Tristano stuff was a lot about independent lines, and I do things kind of with rhythm and making up exercises and playing very slow lines. And just really thinking about sound. And what I'd really like to do now is start thinking about ways that I can apply what I'm doing with Goldberg with the computer and thinking about how I might approach the piano differently. And I think that might be something I get to in the last part of my life. It's coming back.
Well,
yeah, so.
All right, so the Tristano method, that's a whole other, so that's a big influence or it sounds like anyway.
Well, it was a way for me to, I don't want to think of it as a methodology. He was an amazing pianist, and I think there were many people who studied with him that taught differently.
Well, we had Connie Clothers here.
Right. I actually studied with Connie very well. When was that? Like around 1981, I studied with Connie.
Wow, in 81.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was, where was that? Where
that was in Jamaica, Queens. I was studying at Bard for one semester, and I commuted to Queens to study with Connie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, she was certainly one of the major carriers of that.
She was. Yeah. And but what I meant to say is that there are certain kind of really mechanical and listening exercises that he developed that those people used, and I find them useful for me as well.
Wow. Well, great. So you came to New York in 91.
Yes.
And Rutgers. So when did you move into the city? I mean, you've been in the city for some
since
time.
Since 91.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you lived in the city.
I wasn't
while
living
while
in New Jersey.
Commuting out.
I wasn't going to live in New Jersey.
Great. And
my tuition would have been much cheaper. I should have. But anyway.
Right. Well, great. So you've been here ever since, more or less. Although,
yes.
Although as we were talking earlier, and as I've observed in the last few years, you seem to spend an awful lot of time abroad.
I do.
And so tell me more about that. I mean, of course, we know that there's a thriving music scene in Europe that, it's certainly for the more experimental realms. But how has it been? How has it happened that you've found so much work there and so much activity there? And how is that for you?
Complicated.
Yeah.
but basically good. I'd been touring in various formations. I was in a band throughout the 90s and the aughts with a guy named Ellery Eskelin and Jim Black, that's kind of more in the avant jazz scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this the group that you recorded a record on, Knitting Factory?
This is all Ellery's music.
I see.
I did make some records on Knitting Factory, but Ellery was with other labels.
I see.
But we toured quite a lot, and I got familiar with being in Europe, and I also was performing solo here and there in other contexts, more than the improv scene, which is different. I just started to feel kind of that there was more, I observed that the way of life there would probably be more conducive to me being there, because I'm generally pretty wound up, and it's good for me to be in a place that's a little less wound up. I work better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, New York is very stimulating and wonderful, and I have loads of friends here, and there's tons to do, but the pace of it is a little much for me.
I see.
And maybe it's because I grew up in the country, I think I might be getting back to something slower.
Uh-huh.
So it's the pace, and there's plenty to do, and there are great musicians. So it's just another place. I mean, this is, it's wonderful here and wonderful there for different reasons.
Right. So is your sort of your vehicle to get over there mostly through residencies and or tours? I mean, are you able to sustain yourself through just performances throughout Europe? Or
I also teach.
While in Europe?
Well, I teach at a low residency program in the U.S. that allows me to live wherever I need to.
I see.
And I do some visiting artist stints here and there, mostly in the U.S. Right. But most of my gigs are in Europe.
Right. And mostly concentrated in particular cities or
No,
throughout?
No, throughout, I would say.
And where? So you're just coming back from Europe?
A few weeks ago,
A few weeks ago, okay. And you're going back...
Sure. On election day.
On election day, right?
I'm going to vote in the morning and get on the plane and wake up in Germany on the 9th. And whatever it is, it is. But I won't be here.
You'll be safe over there.
Well, temporarily. But anyway.
We'll see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But that's a great escape hatch you have there. I envy you.
I envy me
too.
I'd
love to vote in the morning and be in Berlin in the afternoon on election day. But
yeah.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Well, tell me more about your teaching. So you're teaching what was it Goddard?
Teach at Goddard, has a program called the Masters of Fine Arts and Interdisciplinary Arts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously a grad program, and I work with 7 graduate students per semester who are all doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are mid-career. Some of them have very, very evolved practices, so I'm quite on my toes to keep up with them. And some of them don't have evolved practices, and that requires another set of skills.
Right. And you said it's a low residency program, so you come together at Goddard every periodically?
At the beginning of the semester, you know, we get together, we figure out what they're going to do, and they are blessed, and they go out, they go forth.
Right.
And...
So you have correspondence, I presume, wherever
happen
to be. And,
yes, plenty of correspondence.
And Skype sessions and that
plenty
sort of
those. Lots of attention is paid.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, that sounds like a wonderful mix that you have going there.
Well, what's nice about that job is that I actually have very few music students. I have filmmakers, I have choreographers, I have performers. Sometimes people who have very esoteric or very idiosyncratic practices that you couldn't make up, you know, there's like no way you could make up what these people are doing. You know, it's because they took their time and things evolved and it turned into what it turned into, which I certainly relate to, because if anybody had told me I'd be playing that thing, you know, at this time in my life, I would have been...
Through that Fender amp.
The Fender amp I would have believed,
but
not an accordion.
Okay.
I would have been very disturbed to know that. But anyway.
Right, well, so what would be disturbing about that? Just that it's a sort of a poor version of a piano? Or what?
No, because I grew up as a kind of, you know, Europeanized bourgeois snob, you know,
what were your main passions in the classical literature as a pianist?
Oh, it changed, of course, as I was growing up. I always was attracted to what to my ears was dissonant music.
Mm-hmm.
So in what that might have meant, you know, I was fortunate to grow up in a home where almost everybody was a musician, and there was a lot of music of vastly different types going on. So there was Elvis, and there was Prokofiev, and there was Stravinsky, and there was Mozart, and there was the Beatles, and there was, you know, James Brown, and there was Jimi Hendrix, and there was no high-low,
right,
which was really wonderful. So it was all great. I didn't know that Stravinsky was difficult music. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just thought it was great music. And so for me, when I heard Thelonious Monk, I thought, okay, jazz piano. And then when I got to Berkeley and someone said, okay, you've got to transcribe this Oscar Peterson solo, I was like, why? But I didn't say, because I thought, okay, obviously I don't understand something here. But with all due respect to Oscar Peterson, but still, you know. Carla Bley was important to me. Like, Carla Bley was important to me. Mm-hmm. Kurt Vile was important to me. Eric Dolphy became important to me.
Right.
You get the drift. It's sonic. It's timbral.
But from
you know.
The classical realms, I mean, so I'm just trying to visualize what you know what you were playing when you were 17
Bach,
or whatever. Right?
Beethoven, Barber.
Bartok?
Not so much Bartok. Sorry, no more bees. Let's see, a little Brahms. Satie. But in my early 20s, there was a lot of Satie, a lot of Prokofiev. Mm-hmm. There was the what I call the tendonitis Prokofiev sonata, D minor number 2. Okay.
Uh-huh. Ouch.
Yeah. It's that D minor triad over and over and over. Mm-hmm. Triplets.
Liszt?
No.
Chopin? No.
Small hands.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, small hands, you know.
I see.
Debussy. You
know. Great.
And a little bit of Schoenberg.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, and here we are with the accordion.
And here we are with these things.
So when you're touring with Ellery Eskelin, or when you were in that project, was that accordion based and pitch based, I gather? Or playing
pitch
tunes
based.
And improvising on, not
yeah.
so much with the sound art and the Max Patches.
Well, actually, what was marvelous about Ellery, though he was coming from that scene, was that he had very big ears, and kind of anything he found out that I could do, he eventually found out a way to use it. Mm-hmm. And in a way that was hard for me, because it might be that I would be playing accordion and organ and laptop. And within the same tune, kind
right.
of have to move very artfully mm-hmm. through them and to them,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes simultaneously. Well, can you play the left hand on that, and you know, right hand on that, and you know, like
right.
touch the ceiling with your left toe? And I was like, sure, you know, because like that's what you know you have to, right? Because
right.
That's the way it works. So he was quite game for whatever we could do. And what was interesting about that band was that it was. In the beginning, the writing was very dense,
mm-hmm.
and over time, there was less and less on the page, and there was much more trust that we could manifest something that
right.
was really what he was looking for. He would talk about it, we would rehearse a bit, and you know, and it would manifest, but we were together for 16 years, so that we started in 94 mm-hmm. and stopped in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've assumed that we've stopped, but who knows, you know.
Right.
Seems like it, but who knows. Yeah.
Great. Well, good. Well, a couple other questions. So did I read correctly somewhere that you have a forthcoming double CD on Experimental Intermedia? Is that
It's in the works. Well, how soon that will happen is anybody's guess.
Right.
But it's in the works. It's in the can. It's just a question about how we can do it. Just in terms of some logistics and some finances.
Right. So what is that material?
That material is a piece that I began working on in 2013 mm-hmm. at a residency in Brussels,
mm-hmm.
QO2 workspace for experimental music and
mm-hmm.
sound art. And that I continued to work with the following year at Harvest Works at a residency there, and it was finally premiered at Governor's Island.
What was the title of
that? It's called Two Rooms from the Memory Palace.
Right. I heard that, yes.
Yeah, well, I had a version of it in Harvest Works, so it was like...
Well, I heard it at Governor's Island.
Oh, you saw
well.
That? Yeah, it was pretty... I took over Harvest Works for a while with that thing.
Right.
But it's a piece for two and possibly even three rooms, but
uh-huh.
I'm calling it two rooms for now, with some very saturated material
mm-hmm.
That is quite static, and then another set of material that's a kind of randomized playlist of smaller sounds
right.
that are made from small objects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with the Harvest Works version and also the QO2 version, There was one set of material in one room and one in the other. At Governor's Island, I actually put that material, the smaller stuff, the quieter stuff, inside the larger stuff. There was a passageway through two rooms. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it was like a little closet that you walked through where you heard it, but everything else is, of course, right, bleeding through. And I'm doing a version of it in Montreal next weekend at Acousma, which is a festival that's crazy. They've got 40 speakers. Wow. And I don't quite know what to do with 40 speakers, but I'm going to try.
So this will be a multi-channel.
It is a multi-channel piece. This will be multi-speaker. It's actually an 8-channel piece.
Will it be a performance or an installation or a continuous kind of installation?
Well, the piece was fixed media, but they've asked me to do a version that would include some performance. So mm-hmm. I'm going to do the quiet stuff live, and the saturated stuff will be in the overall listening space.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, they have quite a tradition of that sort of...
The very large array. Yeah.
That's great. Well, yeah. Great. So that's the majority of the EXI project will be this body.
That's that one. Yep.
One on each CD or something.
And I should mention that next week, Brian Chase and I, who have a duo together, have a CD coming out mm-hmm. on Confront Recordings from the UK mm-hmm. called Avalanche of Roots. Avalanche of Roots, R-O-U-T-E-S.
Uh-huh.
Or routes, I guess it would be in Pennsylvania. Routes. But that doesn't sound as good. Avalanche of Routes.
Great, congratulations. And that's going to be a CD. It will be available domestically as well?
It'll be available at the show.
Are you playing a show next week here
in
New York?
We are at the Stone on the 19th on Wednesday.
Great.
Are we at 8 or 10? 8 p.m.
Great. Nice.
During Brian Chase's week at the Stone. Go every night.
Of course.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, well, so let's talk about...
And that was my conversation with composer and sound artist Andrea Parkins on Thursday, October 13th, 2016. The evening continued with a solo electroacoustic performance that used electronically processed accordion, amplified objects, and small instruments. Here now is Andrea Parkins performing a work titled One Room After Another at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.